The theme for the evening talk is a question of consciousness. In the past year or two, there has been something of an explosion of what one might call, referred to as satsang teachers. And particularly noticeable in quite a few European countries. And some of you in here would never have heard the word satsang before, so I'll comment on it. And satsang is men and women coming together for spiritual exploration, and with a teacher present. It's a word which comes out of the Advaita, non-dual or Hindu tradition, and some form of dialogue takes place, and perhaps with long silences. And in a number of cities throughout Europe, and also in the US, but mostly concentrated in Europe, satsang teachers are coming, and various numbers of people, sometimes 3, 4, 5, 10 to 100 or 200, coming to attend satsang. And in its very best, satsang is, as it were, speaking from the source, speaking from the source of consciousness, consciousness with a capital C here. And the purpose with the satsangs is to endeavor to point to something deep and profound in the moment. And and some of the teachers who are coming from that are coming from a man named Punjaji, who lived in Lucknow, North India, who I had some meetings with about a decade ago. And others are coming from Pune, from Osho's place, and mid-70s I had a couple of one-to-one meetings with him. I was already a teacher at that time, not a student. And some have come from what they describe as some spontaneous realization or spontaneous experience, and offering and giving satsang. I mentioned this to a good woman, a friend of mine, who has attended several of them, and I said, what do you think of the satsang? And her comment was, it's just a new expression of the male ego. And so sometimes it can be a little bit of that, but to be absolutely fair, there are some very fine and dedicated satsang teachers who are really are making a contribution to, as it were, directing or pointing that, pointing back to the source, pointing back to consciousness. And that aspect in the tradition of the East is very, very important, and I'd just like to give some commentary on what is meant by that. I was reading just recently a magazine, Newsweek magazine, and a few weeks ago it had a feature on science and mysticism. And in the flow of this lengthy article, it was examining through neuroscientists the brain, and was trying to work out, as it were, why certain women and men have deep mystical experiences, and what could be going on in the brain that triggers such a state or such a reaction. And when I read through my own response, and those I would say coming out of my brain cells, was that science seems to have a terrible job with consciousness. It can find virtually everything else in the brain, but it doesn't know, quite know where this consciousness actually is. And even though it comes and puts everything under the microscope, and obviously highly sophisticated microscopes, it seems to be able to find everything, but it somehow has a problem dealing with what is consciousness. It just doesn't seem to fit under the microscope. And this problem is because though we may have great affection and respect for scientific discoveries, and we also may feel tremendous criticism at other scientific discoveries for not considering the consequences, that somehow we need to, in our relationship to this world, not only look at what we go towards, not only look at what we attend to, but also who or what is doing the looking, who or what is attending to. And there's such a push on our consciousness, that means being conscious of, there is such a push on our consciousness that we find ourselves rather choicelessly, I might say, pushed towards again and again, and not knowing where the pushing started or what happened, that we end up, as it were, rather lost in this world, and as some people have reported in the small group meeting today, sometimes consciousness, as it were, lost in our mind, and we might describe or experience that as confusion.
Yeah.
Oh, just a small thing for those of you who have already found that horizontal posture 2 hours too early. There are three conditions for the horizontal posture. One is you're pregnant. Two, you're sick. And three, history of serious health injuries. Easy. Otherwise, sitting upright. And the reason that I say this is because one wouldn't dream of doing it in the synagogue. Wouldn't dream of listening to the rabbi and saying, well, I think I'll lie down. Spiritual religious teachings, we sit up. I don't mind at all if you go and listen to your prime minister and lie down and have a sleep. I would actually encourage it, because I'm not sure if he has anything worth saying. But in Dharma teachings, take some energy and focus, and it's appreciated by all of us as Dharma teachers for the sitting up. Not easy, I know you're tired at the end of the day, but it's our request, and it's a request that's been made for 2,500 years, and I'm not the one to stop making the request. So sometimes we see there is consciousness, and the consciousness moves towards, and in its movement towards, it gets involved in what we move towards. And outwardly, of course, we need vehicles and instruments, so to speak, to move towards, which we call our senses. And so we have what we could say consciousness connecting with the eye, the seeing, and in that very moment the colour of this world make a contact with us, and it affects the consciousness in that moment. We might call it eye consciousness or sight consciousness. And similarly with the ears, and similarly with the smells and the sounds. And this world is going on, and there's something not unique, but something obviously quite distinctive for us between each of the senses. They're not the same, and yet they are organs which give us a relationship to this world in a particular way. And so here's this world coming, we call sight, and that's one organ. It tells us about the world in a certain way, but then the sounds come, and then it tells us it in another way. And then we smell it, and then the world is revealed in another way. We taste in another way. We touch, and in another way. And each time, though, that activity is taking place, the consciousness is affected. But it's not only affected by the apparent separateness, but also it's affected by our inner life. And we notice again and again how our consciousness, as I just said, is just drawn and pulled into the states of mind. And when we get pulled into the states of mind, we can get absorbed with it, we can get very much identified with it, and consciousness is kind of, as it were, mixed in with it, and that's our primary experience at that time. And we might wonder, if we ever have wondered, can we free consciousness from being moment to moment caught up, or rather embroiled, in seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, in emotional life, mental life, thoughts and ideas? Or is consciousness always wrapped up in all of that, and therefore that's our lot in life? We just accept it, okay, how it is for us, and we try to get on as best we can until the nature comes along. And as the Buddhists will say, that King Yama, that's the king of death, wanders around the world every day and selects a number and says, okay, time is up, and just points out a few. Please don't take it personally if you think my fingers are falling on you. They're not. And therefore our short visit and journey to this strange world is over, and it seems like consciousness is really living in the world, involved in it in a whole variety of ways, and as best we possibly can, we're trying to make sense of it all, we're trying to live it as best we can in our own way, and sometimes we're doing it reasonably well, and sometimes we feel like we're just fumbling through existence, not knowing what on earth, literally, what on earth we are doing. And so we end up in one of these dreadful meditation retreats, trying to make sense of it and sense of ourselves, and in some way consciousness trying to make sense of really what's going on. And though the community of scientists and others will have their views, and though we may have a tremendous amount of knowledge about our genetic makeup and our biology and our physics and all of that, it doesn't seem to do us a great deal of good. We've just acquired a lot of information which pours into our poor, overworked, overstressed brain cells, and piles in, and we never seem to get enough of it, and we go on reading and using Amazon and all that to get even more in, and we forget, we still, even for knowledge and information, we are still going outwards. We are still going outwards. And we keep consciousness, we keep thinking the answer some lies out there in our mind, lies out there in the books, lies out there in the teachers, lies out there in satsang or whatever there. And see, we're trying to stop just enough just to check this influence on consciousness, which keeps moving us again and again in that direction. There's rather a nice story of the seeker in the non-dual tradition, Advaita tradition. A number of people went down to the edge of the river to get in the boat to cross to the other side. And there were 10 of them. And when they got to the other side, one who had the responsibility for everybody counted up and said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, oh my God, one is missing. Divided them up, 5 and 4, 6 and 3, 8 and 1, my God, one is missing. And the search went on for the tenth man. It's called the tenth man story, the search went on for the tenth man. And the seeking was going on, the searching was going on, and nobody could find the tenth man. What is missing? And an old fisherman walking down the beach looked at this bizarre situation. It's a story, you know. It may not be absolutely true, I have to say, but I wouldn't be surprised. An old fisherman walking along the beach turned to one of the men who was searching and seeking, and he said to him, "All that you are looking for is none other than your own self." And sometimes in the movement of our life, in this outer movement, the seeking and the searching and the getting and the gathering, we've gone so far in that direction that perhaps what we're really searching for is ourself. What we're really searching for is who we are, and it's got misdirected outwardly through all the conditioning and the forces and the pulls on consciousness and everything that's done to stop us from really finding out who we are. And until we do, there'll never be genuine happiness and real peace of mind, because it's simply not found out there. And if we were to really acknowledge this without even finding consciousness, without even finding the source of consciousness, that we really said to ourselves this evening, true happiness is not found out there, and took that simple truth and let that sit with us and stand with us and walk with us, perhaps there is the possibility of finding out where true happiness is. And it's obviously not in a Sony tape recorder. Even our peculiar scientists, one could take this whole thing apart, and even they might try, would have a job finding happiness in it. Yet somehow we get the idea in the movement, if I had, I would be happy. It would make me happy. How come a strange association between consciousness and happiness has got an association with a Sony tape recorder? You know, we are a weird species. We really have to ask ourselves, are we living on this planet or are we off it? We've made a relationship which, when we touch and look at it, sorry, I hope it, once these things break, they're gone. If we look at it and really attend to it, where on earth is the happiness in it? Why should we associate with it? Yet we go into debt, we work our butt off, we think about all the things that we would like. I don't know if you have these in Israel, but the dreaded nightmare of the lottery. There's a whole world of complete delusion, completely deluded. And somehow, where happiness springs, we take little interest in. We think it's somehow the instrument is out there. Dharma teachings, deep satsang teachings, non-dual teachings. So please stop and question this. Stop and just question this. If we questioned it, it would be a radical shift in the way we lived. It would be a revolution so great it would make what happened in 1917 in Russia like a weekend picnic. Really, you'll see. So making the changes so that when we step back we become aware of the movement towards. And the Buddha, in a beautiful analogy to express this, compares our life. He says like a castle, and the castle has five windows: eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch. The lord of the castle is awareness or consciousness. This is the lord of the castle. And two messengers come to the lord of the castle through the windows, and the mind is also regarded in the Dharma teachings as another window, as another organ which reveals and tells us things in the way that sights and sounds do. So through the five senses and the mind, two messengers come to the lord of the castle, to consciousness. And the names of the two messengers are calm and insight. And the message that they bring to the lord of the castle is the message of liberation, the message of an enlightened consciousness. So if you and I, during our time here together, are willing to be still, and as I say, take an interest in the movement towards, and that if there is enough calmness and enough clarity for us, it could be worth asking or inviting our deeper sense of being a simple question. It can take two forms. Who is aware of all this? Or what is this awareness or this consciousness which keeps revealing? What is it? So the mind raises the question, and therefore the mind is coming from what is in front of us, because we say, oh, my mind today was confused or clear or calm or moving or not moving or happy or sad. So the mind is, as it were, is in front of us. We can see the mind, we can talk about it, we can describe it, as well as we can describe sights and sounds. And so from the mind we generate a question: what's revealing the mind? I mean, states of mind, thoughts, feelings, emotions, pleasurable and painful. What's revealing the mind? Or we could ask, who is seeing all of this? Who is revealing all of this? And so it seems like consciousness is a kind of light which helps to reveal. If I'm conscious, it reveals seeing. If I'm conscious, it reveals hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. It reveals the states of mind that I'm going through at the present time. So consciousness is like a light which keeps revealing all of this day in and day out to us. The question is that all that consciousness reveals? Is that all that it reveals? And of course, deep spiritual teachings say no, absolutely not. We might think and we might believe and assume that all consciousness is can reveal is my states of mind, deep and profound, superficial and with quality, gross and subtle, and all the changes, all that my consciousness can reveal about is what's going on in the present moment, or reveal through memories what has happened or what might happen. And that's all, because that's why? It's all I know. That's all I know. Why is it all I know? Because I keep landing in all of that, keep moving towards all of that. Is it possible for us to be conscious, feel this, even though we can't locate it anywhere in the body? Can't say, oh, it's in my brain, we can't say it's in my heart, or we can't actually find a location, yet just different sensations arise. Sometimes they're conscious and we feel, oh yeah, something going on in the head up here today, and conscious, oh, the old knees are tingling away there, a few odd twinges in the back, and that person sitting next to me is still snoring. And so the consciousness keeps revealing what it's connected with, which is a function of consciousness. But could we be so conscious that in spite of all that it keeps revealing, the state of being so conscious may begin to give a little intimation of much more than what's familiar and known? We can only find out through our experience. We can only find out through being conscious, or to use other words we use here, being mindful or being aware. And we take an interest when you and I move towards, and we say, well, that's quite natural, it's quite normal. We move towards seeing and hearing and walking and eating, and we move towards doing things, of course we do. But it would be a pity if that's all we ever do. It would be a pity if we don't take an interest in the light which keeps revealing this existence. A light which can say to us, now I can see, now I can hear, now I can smell, now I can taste. And therefore something making that obvious to us. Two or three years ago we had in Bodh Gaya, this is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, and I had mentioned this incident a couple of years ago when I was here. It touched me, and it still does every time I think about it. And it was in retreat we had an inquiry, and it's very at retreat, some of you have been to it, in Bodh Gaya, is very international, usually 15 or 20 nationalities, and lots of brothers and sisters from Israel there. And one German man was blind, completely blind. And for the walking meditation, every day one different person acted as his guide. And the way that we did it was, the blind person, who was old, he was about 70 years of age, put his hands on the shoulders of one of the other yogis and just followed. And so for the 45 minute period he did the walking meditation with the hands on the shoulders, and just did his walking meditation and guided him back into the meditation hall to sit. And in an inquiry with this man, I said to him, but what happened? Nothing there, just no eyes, just gone. He just wears dark glasses and just raw flesh. I said to him, what how did you become blind? What happened? And he said, 50 years ago he was forced, as many other young men, 18, 19 years of age, to fight in Hitler's army. And he said to me, one of your countrymen pulled the pin out and threw an hand grenade at me and other soldiers in the war. It hit the ground in front, and a piece of the shrapnel, as it does, left the ground, and he said in one moment both eyes were taken out, and nothing since. And then he said, which is I found a very touching moment, he said, isn't it ironic? 50 years ago, an Englishman at war with Germany took my eyes out, and 50 years later, it is an Englishman who is teaching me to see. Sometimes in life we just, the way circles of life move round, we just... And we were all very, of course, obviously very touched, and everyone else there, and it was very touching. Many some of the Israeli friends, you know, afterwards were giving him a big hug, and it meant a lot to him. That really touched him deeply. So sometimes in this world that we live in, we think, and the point of that, what I'm trying to get to here, is that the truth of life will just come to our eyes and to our ears. But because we've become so infatuated with it and all our layers of projections and so forth, we're actually, rather than seeing, we're blinded through the infatuation with the world. And we really can't see it because we've got like coloured sunglasses, approving of this, disapproving of that, liking of this, not liking of that, wanting of this, not wanting of that. We can't see it clearly, and yet we imagine we can through our eyes and ears. But the Buddha said, if the eyes and the ears were a problem, then those who are blind and those who are deaf would be much closer to the truth, because they don't have the problem of having to see or having to hear. But there's no evidence for that either. So somehow it's learning to see, I mean, this eyes and ears, etc., acknowledge the validity of that, yet look at the seeker, look at the witness, be with the consciousness, be with the awareness, be with that light which is revealing life, and perhaps in that light which is revealing life, that which it truly reveals can become clear and obvious, and there's something enlightening about it, and something liberating about it. And from that consciousness, everything else begins to fall into place. The world kind of is okay in some extraordinary sense. And these teachings and practices and inner work and inner inquiry are reminding us of the importance of all of that. And it would be a pity to make our journey through life and never come back to the source of that which keeps revealing the life. We are caught up too much in what is revealed, and we've lost the sense and the appreciation and the recognition of what's actually revealing it, which we call consciousness. And this is our journey of discovery. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings live with pure consciousness. May all beings explore that light which reveals all. Let's have a minute or two quiet spiritually.